The beginning of this week's parasha, and by the way, there's like this general theme that seems to take place in Sefer Bereishit, that when you start a parasha at the beginning of the parasha, you miss the story because it actually began a little bit before, or inevitably begins a little bit before. If we were to trust the beginning of the parasha, it says, "Vayetze Yaakov Beersheva leCharana." Yaakov leaves Beersheva and he starts his journey to Charan. On the other hand, if you were to look at the end of last week, it actually says a little bit earlier that Yaakov was sent, and apparently he went on his way. Vayishma Yaakov el avi ve'elimo vayelech pardana aram. He listens to his parents, and he goes. So why should the Torah come back and tell us again? So there's probably many, many answers you can give, and most of them maybe better than all I'm about to say. But if you look at the end of last week's parsha, you'll notice that Yaakov actually was sent to go to Padana Aram for two different reasons. Yes? He's sent for two different reasons to go. He was sent by his mother, and he was sent by his father. And that's not necessarily the same mission that he was sent on. His mother said to him, she knows that Esav wants to kill him, "Vata benish ma bikoli, bikum brach lecha el Lavan achi charana. Go run away and go to Lavan, go to my brother's house, and there you'll be protected." So therefore, Yaakov is on a mission from his mother in order to go to Haran. On the other hand, afterwards, Rivka puts on the theatrics, although she may be sincere, and she starts to say, telling her husband, you know, if Yaakov were to marry these girls, you know, like Esav did, these local girls, you know, it'll be my death. Then Yitzhak calls Yaakov in and says, "Kum lech padana aram beita betuel avi imecha." You know, go. You should go and travel, which means Yaakov is on two different missions to go to the same place. So the fact that he's on two different missions maybe is not such a surprise that he leaves twice. Now, when I say he leaves twice, of course, I'm only being semi-serious, but in terms of pshat, he is asked to leave twice. In terms of pshat, he's going for two different reasons. So in terms of pshat, therefore, to find that that twice it tells us that he leaves, maybe should not be all that surprising. This, by the way, is the kind of thing that Rav Breuer, if you ever heard of Rav Breuer, would have been all over, and he would have. On the one hand, Rav Breuer looked at the text very much in terms of as a literature, and sometimes as a literature in terms of multiple voices, not multiple authors, but as multiple voices. Once he had multiple voices, because there may have been multiple missions or multiple trips or multiple roles that were being played, so therefore you may have different voices describing those different missions. And once you have different voices, he ended up dealing with a lot of the contentions of Bible criticism, and who were dealing ultimately with multiple voices because of multiple authors, but he was dealing with multiple voices because of multiple roles by protagonists. Anything I just said make any sense, or I lost all of you already? Did anybody understand what I said, or no? Yes? Yes? Made sense? Because your background is in literature, so your background is in literature, so yes, that makes a great deal of sense what he's saying. But again, for us, Yaakov leaves twice. For us, maybe we'll cut all this down and make this a lot simpler. Yaakov had a very difficult life. And by the way, all along, Yaakov had a difficult life. I don't know how you cannot feel bad for Yaakov. But from the beginning all the way to the end, Yaakov has a very, very difficult existence. And one of the things that I want to explore today, with the beginning of Parshat Vayetzeh, but I'm going to go back a lot into Toldot because we missed it, but especially in the beginning of Vayetzeh, something really significant happens that maybe we take for granted or maybe that we just gloss over. But I would want to phrase the question maybe, or even the whole discussion, in the following sense. To what extent is Yaakov Avinu a spiritual character? So now you'll say, what kind of question that is? I mean, he's one of the Avots. Of course he's a spiritual character. Yeah, he is. But there's a lot of things that Yaakov does which is morally challenging. And that doesn't mean, by the way, that Yaakov is a morally challenged individual. It means, again, that Yaakov is placed in very, very difficult situations. So now, how he responds to those situations is where the challenge comes. But Yaakov, last week, last parsha, in Toldot, was, I think all of us will understand, he's in an impossible situation, and we're going to have to understand where that comes from. You know, what comes up. Basically, his mother's telling him one thing, his father's telling him something else, or his mother's even telling him to be deceitful to his father. So bless you. What happens when someone's mother tells them to be deceitful for their father? Either you listen to your mother and then you're deceitful, or you don't listen to mother and then you're not listening to your mother, which means straight off, Yaakov is in an impossible situation. And to what extent he was actively involved, to what extent he had no choice, or at least limited choice, that's something which we can consider. Okay. Well, I'll try to come back to Rav Hirsch, else there's no reason for me to give this class at all, right? Right. So, in the beginning of this week, and let's start here, and then we'll start moving backwards. Vayetze Yaakov mi-Be'er Sheva ve'el Charana. Yaakov leaves Be'er Sheva, and he heads towards Haran. Vayifga b'makom, and he struck in the place. By the way, the word makom is going to come again and again, three times in this pasuk. So you'll have to ask yourself what the significance of makom is. I mean, is it just an anonymous place? Then why state it like that? Vayifga b'makom, vayilin sham, and he rested there, kiva hashemesh, of course the sun has set. Vayikach mavnei makom, and he takes from the stones of that place. Vayosem yoshotav, and puts them under his head. Vayishkav b'makom ahu, and he rested in that place. Now, how do you read a pasuk like this? So if we read it locally, so again, the thing that jumps out is this place. So what is the place? We don't know. Where is he? Well, as of this point, we don't have the name of a place yet, but as of this point, we do know one thing. And what is that? He's someplace in between, where? Be'er Sheva and Haran. Where is he along that route? We don't necessarily know yet. What else strikes us? And this is something which did occupy a number of the commentaries, and this is when they looked at it not in terms of a local analysis, but rather they compared it to the last person who took the same trip. Who was the last person who took this trip, or maybe took half of this trip? That would be the Eved Avraham, right? The Eved of Avraham. If you want, I can say Eliezer, even though that it never says Eliezer in that particular chapter. He's always called Eved Avraham in that chapter, unless he's called Ha'ish, or unless he's called something else. But he's never called Eliezer. We use our theory of conservation of characters in order to call him Eliezer, because at another point, Avraham's Eved is Eliezer, so therefore we assume it's Eliezer. Okay. When the Eved Avraham, when Avraham's servant, takes the same trip, and when I say it's the same trip, the trip in order to go from Eretz Yisrael to Haran, in order to try to find a wife for one of the patriarchs, how does he go? He goes with a great deal of wealth. He goes with his camels, and he goes with his jewelry, and he carries with him a whole bunch of things. Now, what does Yaakov leave with? So over here, it depends on how you look at Yaakov. What does Yaakov go off with? So what's the answer? Well, it depends. One answer is apparently he walks off with nothing. We don't hear of any camels. We don't hear of any jewelry. We don't hear anything. There's actually an interesting discussion, which I believe that Ibn Ezra begins, where he says that Yitzchak had lost all the family money. By the time Yaakov leaves, there was no money left in the family. He went bankrupt. Whether that's actually the case or not. And this is evidence, because Yaakov leaves. On the other hand, how does Yaakov leave? Very, very quickly. Yaakov leaves in great haste. Why? Because, he's on a dual mission. One mission is to go find a wife. So if you're just going to find a wife, I compare it with Eliezer, and I say, well, look at all the stuff Eliezer has. Why doesn't Yaakov have anything? On the other hand, I remember that Yaakov has another reason for going. And what's the other reason? His brother wants to kill him. So if his brother wants to kill him, then you leave as quickly as possible, and maybe you didn't have time to go and do the rest. So therefore, the Ibn Ezra's contention that Yaakov, and therefore Yitzchak by extension, were poor at this point, is based upon only analyzing it compared to one half of his mission, and perhaps ignoring the other half of the mission. If I do want to compare it, then when I get to the next scene, I also have a scene with the well, and I have a scene with feeding, with giving to drink, and so on. Although it's the opposite over here, instead of the proposed bride bringing water for the Eved Avraham and the camels, in that case, over here we have Yaakov going and getting water and giving it to Rachel and to her animals. Which, by the way, right there would be a real interesting message that he's saying. Saying, I am the son of Rivka. Look, I am acting like Rivka. I'm being very Rivka-like, and therefore there is this personal connection between us. So, again, Yaakov's behavior at that point makes a great deal of sense, but again, I still have to note that Yaakov goes there basically with the clothes on his back. Where he sleeps right now is actually part of the story. Yaakov has nothing. But what does he have? He does have one thing. And what is it? You're going to have to at some point speak. What does he have? Okay, you won't speak. Well, that he finds. What does he have? He has brachot. Brachot. Blessings. Yaakov walks off with blessings. Well, but that's what's interesting. And why is his life in danger right now? Because he has blessings. So Yaakov has all the blessings in the world. I mean, I guess in economics you can think about that in terms of, you know, futures. You know, he has some kind of a future which will come to fruition, but in the present Yaakov has nothing. By the way, that I think is a wonderful metaphor, because right now at this moment Yaakov not only is walking off with the future blessing, Yaakov walking off right now represents all of Klal Yisrael. Yaakov is right now an entire nation, but he's an entire nation which is encapsulated into one person. By the time he comes back, and again, you have to make that comparison as well, because that's in this week's parsha, he leaves, he's one lonely man with nothing, except for brachot. When he comes back, well, he actually did a little better than Eliezer did. He comes back with not one wife, he comes back with arguably four wives. He comes back with a whole bunch of kids, right? And he comes back with a whole bunch of wealth as well. Of course, all this wealth came to be realized while he was there working for Lavan. So therefore, the Yaakov that leaves and the Yaakov that comes back is not the same Yaakov. Of course, I would argue that it is the same Yaakov. Over here, it's all in potential. And over here, the potential begins to unfold and the reality begins to present itself to us. So therefore, we do get an appreciation of Yaakov at the beginning and Yaakov, you know, at the end of the parasha. But again, what's striking now is over here, where does he go to sleep? He goes to sleep on the floor. What does he use as pillows? He uses rocks as pillows. Which means over here we really do have a sense of a man at this particular moment. All the brachot in the world, and now you have to really appreciate it, he's got these brachot which have now put his life in danger, and he has absolutely nothing. He has, in reality, has nothing. He has rocks to sleep on. Sleeping on the floor, on the run, sleeping with rocks. But he has brachot that someone wants to kill him for, which of course have not done anything for him. So that's the situation. What else does he have? And that's what the Torah doesn't tell us. And this is what I'm going to make up, and you can afterwards tell me I'm right or wrong. It makes no difference. But now I'm reading into it. So let's go back a little bit with the tension. Why is Yaakov in this situation in the first place? Which situation? Why does he have to run away, and why does he have all these brachot? Why does he have these? Okay, he has these brachot, and therefore he has to run away. But why does he have all of this? Meaning, why is he in the situation that he's in? The answer is because he listened to his mother. Right? If he didn't listen to his mother, then he wouldn't have the brachot. He didn't have the brachot. He wouldn't have to run away. He'd still be living, arguably, you know, arguing with the Ibn Ezra, he would still be living in the luxury of his father's home, and so on and so forth. Which means, these brachot, did they make his life better, or did they ruin his life? So at this particular moment, when I asked the question, well, it didn't seem to make it better, well, not yet. Maybe, again, by the end of the parasha, maybe a different story. Now let's pause again. Here's the larger question, which I keep dancing around, and I'm going to finally say it clearly. What about Yaakov's relationship with God? Do you see that at all as being a question? Which means, his father says this, and his mother says this, and he fools his father, he listens to his mother. Okay, I'll say it clearly. Who said he was right to listen to his mother? I mean, we will later, but I'm saying right now, who said that he's right? Ultimately, okay, he stole the brachot. Does God have to acquiesce? That's it, you took the bracha, now I'm going to make them all come true. Couldn't God... I mean, it's funny. We have like this funny thought about brachot. Just because Bilam's going to curse, it's really going to work? Just because Yaakov gives a bracha, Yitzchak gives a bracha, it's really going to work? I know it's not nice for someone to curse you. It's very nice for someone to bless you. But isn't it ultimately upon God to make these brachot come true? I mean, is God sitting there in heaven, okay, you know, I can't do anything now because, you know, you stole the bracha? Or can God say, sorry, you know, he gave the bracha to Esav. I don't care that his hands were on top of your head. It's not going to you, which means, can we really force the hand of God? Maybe we think we can. Maybe we think when we pray that God has no choice anymore. We pray, that's it, God has to listen to us. Do you at least find this question intriguing or not at all? Which means, what is going to be the nature right now of the relationship between Yaakov and God? And more importantly, what is going to be God's response to what Yaakov has done till this point. Because without asking those questions, you absolutely cannot understand what takes place over here in the beginning of this parsha. Now I want to move backwards a little bit to understand how we got to this point, and now we do have to move a little bit into last week's parsha. Although I will add that Yaakov's expectations over here are really quite modest. Yaakov says, he makes a neder. Do I have the neder here? Yes. Posek kaf, in the end of the first source. Vayidar Yaakov neder lemor, yeah, Elokim imadi, if God will be with me, ushmarani bederech, and guard me along the way. This path. Asher enochi holeich, v'natan li lechem lechol u'begid lubosh. If God will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear. What are Yaakov's, quote-unquote, demands of God at this point? Or requests of God? Protect me. Give me clothing and give me bread. By the way, does that sound like a man who's asking for wealth, or does that sound like a man who's traveling and he does not know how he's going to get to where he's going and doesn't know how he's going to eat? Which means Yaakov's requests over here are not bread to eat, clothing to wear. I think most of us in our daily prayers, when we either think about or even articulate what we need, we're not as modest as Yaakov Avinu is in terms of his needs. Even shelter, he didn't ask for. He didn't ask for shelter. He said, protect me along the way. So again, I can understand that as shelter, but he didn't even ask for that. Why? Because he's sleeping on the ground. He has rocks for pillows, nothing. So Yaakov's requests over here really, really show us how modest it is. Okay. So, how did we get here? So let's move back a little bit. What is it that Rav Hirsch said, which we find, which everybody loves, by the way. Everybody loves it today. It's politically correct, and therefore it's very popular. But there's sometimes an inverse relationship between what's popular versus what's true. He says that basically Yitzchak and Rivka ruined Esav. Because you always need there to be Yitzchak and Rivka, they ruined Esav. They made an educational error. He claims that they treated their two children exactly the same, and that's why Esav became Esav. And he goes on to say how you need different education now for different people. Now, by the way, this is actually part of a much larger and much more interesting discussion where, in terms of the macro issues that Rav Hirsch brings up, I happen to agree with him. In terms of his micro example that he uses as his evidence, I happen to disagree with him. The question actually, the debate really came up between Rav Breuer, who was a son-in-law, I forgot which Rav Breuer, the son-in-law or grandson of Rav Hirsch, and between Rav Eliyahu Dessler, the Mechtav Eliyahu, which is basically the difference between the philosophy of Torah Avodah, which at some point may become Torah of Derech Eretz, in the Hirschian model, which may or may not become Torah of Amado, versus what we can call the Kula Torah. Rav Dessler basically said that the Haredi position, which still is today, is that if you have 1,000 kids, you throw them all into the Beit Midrash, and maybe one Gadol B'Torah will come out of it. But if you don't throw those 1,000 kids in, you're not going to end up with even one Gadol B'Torah. And therefore, being that we need to invest in our Gadolei Torah, we need to throw 1,000 kids in, even though, by definition, then 999 of them are going to fail to different gradations of failure. Some will fail completely because the education was just not for them. The Hirsch, the German school of Hirsch, of Breuer, and so on, their philosophy was people who have interest and aptitude to learn, you put them in yeshivot, and other people, you educate them in terms of their own interests and aptitude. So therefore, he jumps over here in Yitzchak and Rivka, and he says, look, they're old-fashioned, didn't know much about education, and they messed up Esav because they gave Esav the exact same education that they gave to Yaakov. So that's really the background. I mean, it's always unfortunate when biblical commentators have an agenda, because when they have an agenda, then sometimes they read the text through, you know, somewhat jaundiced eyes. So if anybody's totally outraged at me for picking on Rav Hirsch right now, I apologize. The other thing that he says in this week's parasha, you can read it and you can decide if you like it or not. When it comes to this whole section of the Dudaim, when Rachel and Leah are there and Reuven brings back the Dudaim and Rachel says, give it to me, and Leah says, no, I'll take it, and they go. So he says this was just a playful conversation between two women who got along fabulously and there was no tension and nothing going on, which sounds complete fantasy as far as everything else that you read within the parasha, where you do see how Leah feels so disenfranchised and how Rachel has jealousy towards her sister, that he just completely ignores the words and says, oh, what a lovely, you know, picture we have of this wonderful family life that that everybody enjoyed. You know, one man, four wives, and everyone living happily in harmony, and so on and so forth. You take him tonight. No, you take him tonight. And so, again, if you read it, it's just astounding that he can say such a thing. So I said, there you have a reverse of difficulty in this week's portion again. But going back to the one last week, I don't know what he's talking about, because the verses themselves seem to be completely rebel against his suggestion. Why do I say that? Because the psukim say it. The psukim say something which is really quite difficult. I'm back in Perikafe Pasakov Zayin. Do we have this here? Yes. You have it in source 6. Pasuk of Zion. Vayigadlu an arim, and the children grew up. Vayihi Esav ish yodeyatzayit ish sadeh, and Esav became an outdoorsman. Vayakov ish tam yoshev avalim, and Yaakov was a simple man of tents. So here, I think, is the key pasuk. First of all, it points towards dysfunctionality. Any of you come from dysfunctional families, you can rest assured it goes all the way back to here. Pasuk Kaf Chet. Ve'yahav Yitzchak es Esav ki tzayid b'fiv. Yitzchak loved Esav because the hunt was in his mouth. Rivka hevet et Yaakov, and Rivka loved Yaakov. Where's the difficulty in that pasuk? Okay, there's two parts of difficulty. One difficulty is that it says that Yitzchak loves Esav, and it gives a reason. It should have said Yitzchak loves. It should say a parent loves a child. First of all, the fact that it divides it up, that the father loves this one, the mother loves this one, that itself is somewhat disturbing. The love that Rivka has for Yaakov is a more natural love. What does it say? Rivka loves Yaakov. Why? It doesn't give a reason. I don't know. Do any of your parents, do you ask them why they love you? Or is that some kind of a biological condition?
But if it's not dependent on something, why didn't she love Esau?
I'll come back to that. That's a good question. I said that's part of what's disturbing over here, is really the lack of symmetry which takes place. Which means over here we have some kind of a disconnect in this family, and the more interesting questions then become, not what are the relationships between Yitzchak and Esav, and Rivka and Yaakov, the more interesting question then becomes, what is the relationship between Rivka and Esav, and between Yitzchak and Yaakov? And over here, it's at this point that some people, I think, can get confused. Because the confusion is going to be based upon what we see at the end of the parasha, namely that Yitzchak wants to give his great blessings to Esav. So therefore, what are we absolutely convinced? That Yitzchak indeed loves Esav. So therefore, everything is nice and neat. It just happens not to be the case. But let me go back again to this pasuk. The fact that it says that Yitzchak loves Esav because the hunt was in his mouth, and it gives a reason why he loves him, what does that tell you? It tells you that here's the kind of love which is a conditional love and not the kind of love that we would expect to be an unconditional love. That, on the one hand, is disturbing. Okay? Later on, before he gives them the blessing, what does he tell them to do? Go hunt, go this, and bring me through. Which means, it's not that he gives them the same education. Quite the opposite. He knows, Yitzchak knows what Esav is good at, and he tries to push him in that direction, and he tries to encourage him in that direction, and he tries to appreciate what Esav is good at. Which is, if you were to ask me, I would say quite the opposite is true. And the truth is, I have to say something else before this point is really going to be clear, but I'll say the opposite is true. I think that Yitzchak and Rivka are actually wonderful parents because they have two very different kids, and they don't raise them the same way. They do not treat them the exact... Treating is a different question. They do not raise them the same way. Esav is encouraged by his father in terms of this hunting. But there's something else we need to remember, and maybe this is part of the most important discussion on this whole parasha. When you reread the description, Esav is a hunter, and Yaakov is a man of the tents, that reminds us of something. Which means this is not in a vacuum. There was a man who was mentioned earlier who was a great hunter. There was a man who was mentioned earlier who's a man of the tents. So who are these two people? Cain and Hevel is good, and it's probably the same kind of tension, but never mentioned as a hunter. There you have farmer versus shepherd tension, but not hunter. Hunter was only one person beforehand was mentioned a hunter, and that was Nimrod. Nimrod is described as a great hunter, and a great. You should like slam the door or something when you walk out. Make believe you're upset. You don't like it. That's much more. Okay, so Nimrod is the only person till this point who is described as a hunter. Now, Nimrod is not an innocent person. As a matter of fact, you know, when all else fails, then you look at the name. The name Nimrod, what does the name mean? There are not very many religious kids who are named Nimrod. Have you ever noticed that? It's almost a guarantee. If a kid names Nimrod, his parents were not religious when they named him. It's almost a guarantee. And by the way, I don't know a Moel who would allow, by a bris, a kid to be named Nimrod. They'd stop it on the spot. Why? First of all, Nimrod was not a good man. He tries to kill Avram Avinu. Secondly, what does the name mean? It means merit. It means rebellion. It means the rebellious person, Nimrod. Nimrod is the one who rebels. Nimrod is described as a hunter. Nimrod tries to kill Avraham Avinu. He's the one who throws Avram into the furnace. Going back a second, who's the man of tents that I was talking about? That's Avraham. Which means Avram sits by his tent and he sees the three people coming, and Avram goes and he performs acts of chesed and so on. Which means, what is our tension right now? We have two kids coming into this family. One of us reminds us of Avram Avinu, and the other one reminds us of Nimrod. Now that itself is, I don't know if the word is shocking, but it's certainly interesting. Which family does this happen to? This happens to this Rivka, Yitzchak family. Now there's something else that we need to keep in mind, which is at the back of everything, and is ultimately going to be the most important issue over here, but I'm still leaving it in the background, but I'm noting that I'm leaving it in the background, while I'll even begin to say what it is, and that is that Rivka has inside information. Okay, so she happens to know something, so let's push that on the side as well. Right now we have our Nimrod and our Avraham, second, you know, Nimrod 2.1 and Avram 2.1, growing up in the same house. Vayigadlu ha-ne'arim, Rashi points out, that the whole time that they were young, Rashi is source number 8, Vayigadlu ha-ne'arim, Vayihi Esav, Kozman shuktanim lo yunikarim b'ma'aseihim. When they were young, they were the same in terms of their behavior. By the way, that's much more. Not that they looked alike, even, or they may or they may not. You don't know. You know, sometimes siblings tend to look alike, even though they're described in very different ways. They may have much more of a similarity than we sometimes imagine. But it says, in terms of their behavior, they were the same. The ain od medakteik behem mativam, and nobody can really tell the difference in terms of the behavior. Kevin shenasu bnei shloshes reshana zepiresh lebatei midrashot vezepiresh leobada zara. So Rashi, of course, using an extreme way of describing it, says it's only when they become adults, or at the age of 13, that one then moves towards spiritual pursuits and one moves towards idolatrous pursuits. But over here, as I said, we have a problem. So how does Yitzchak try to solve the problem? He has a son who reminds him of Avram, of his father, of his saintly father, and he has a son who reminds us of the man who is Avram's protagonist who tries to kill him. That's the challenge that Yitzchak has as a father. So now, to go and say that he raises them both the exact same way, like Rav Hirsch said, well, the failure was that they gave him the exact same education and treated them the same, and that's why Esav became the man who he became, I'm really not that convinced, because what we see is that Yitzchak doing the exact opposite. Yitzchak, ohev oto, he loves him because he gives him hunting. He goes, so he's a hunter, so he's going to love him for his hunting. Again, the point before that is Yitzchak love hunting. Not necessarily. But Yitzchak decides, if my son's going to bring me something that he hunted, I'm going to eat it. Why? Because this is what my son invested himself in. This is what's important to him. Yitzchak becomes the type of father who's not necessarily interested in his son's pursuits, but if his son is interested in his pursuits and he's interested in his son, so now he'll be interested. Yitzchak tags along with his father to a football game. Why? Because his son likes football, so I'll take him to the football game. Okay, so what do you say? What kind of father is that? Is this really what Rav Hirsch describes, or is this somebody who's really trying to take a son and maybe to move in another direction. Later on, of course, I can't disconnect this from the brachot themselves. Later on, when it comes to the brachot, when he says, go and bring me food, and then I'm going to bless you. So now we see Yitzchak trying to do something else. What is Yitzchak trying to do? He's trying to bring the world of spirituality into the world of hunting, which is you're going to bring me food, and I'm going to bless you, which means here blessing gets introduced, or godliness gets introduced into this. By the way, I think I mentioned 2 weeks ago the Targum Yonatan, who suggested that none other than Eliezer was actually a son of Nimrod. So if that can work, did I mention that? I didn't. Okay, but it's interesting anyway. The Targum says it, that Targum Yonatan says it, that it says Eliezer ben Nimrod. So if Eliezer is the son of Nimrod, by the way, where does he say it? When he says that Avram takes all these people with him, all these soldiers, right? So it says all those soldiers, what was the number? 300 and whatever that was. He takes these hundreds of soldiers with him. So there it says, no, that's just Eliezer that he takes with him. So how do you have one guy who's so strong in the battle of the four kings against the five kings? How do you have one guy who's so powerful? So that's what the Targum says. Oh, this is the son of Nimrod. Nimrod's a powerful hunter. Nimrod's a powerful man. But if a man like Eliezer, who could be raised in Nimrod's home, joins Avram, that itself becomes a prototype of taking power and using it towards something which is holy. It becomes the service of within Avram, which means this Yaakov Esav tension may actually have had a possibility of somehow working it out. When I go back a generation and look at Avram's home, where Avram is involved in all this spirituality, but he still has this right-hand man who's a bodyguard. Right, he's a real bodyguard and somebody who's really able to, or as they would call it back in Brooklyn, he's the muscle. He's the guy that Avraham has there in the background. But again, I'm pointing out this unbelievable irony. Now, you know, you get pregnant and you're convinced, you know, what a wonderful mother you'll be till you have a child. And then these children come out, and you look, and one comes out like this, and one comes out like this, and one develops like this, and one develops like this, and maybe parents shouldn't feel that they're always responsible for everything that their children end up becoming. But over here we find two different directions, and we have difficulty. Now, so far, now we're clear. We have Yaakov Esav, which is Avraham Nimrod. We have Yitzchak and Rivka. And how we deal with it. Yitzchak, for his part, seems to be very, very full of attempts to make reconciliation. Yitzchak himself, we find him by the Be'er L'chai Ro'i, which is very interesting. That's the place that Esav has an epiphany. Sorry, Yishmael has an epiphany. Which means Yitzchak seems to go back to where Yishmael connected to God. According to the Midrash, it was Yitzchak who brings Hagar back to Avraham. I don't want to get into psychological analysis and so on, but these... Yitzchak goes back to... We find him a number of times at a place called Be'er L'chai Ro'i. That's the place where Hagar and Yishmael have this epiphany. So why does he find spirituality in that place specifically? It seems to be that Yitzchak is somebody who tries to create some type of a healing. He tries to bring people together. What I started to say is, I don't want to go do what you know you can call a psychological analysis, but maybe Yitzchak, the one, he's born, now his family gets broken up, he's born and Yishmael gets sent away, so maybe he feels that he wants to keep people together, he wants to keep the family together, he wants to reunite the family, he wants to bring Yishmael back, he wants to bring Hagar back. And maybe he's saying that he will do everything he can possibly do not to allow a son like Esav to break up the family. Which really leads me to my main point, which will have various levels to it. Yitzchak's ultimate approach is that this is one family, and they will remain one family. This is not the approach of Rivka. Now, how do I know this? Right? How do I know that Yitzchak believes that they are ultimately one family? So I'm going to point something out which is incredibly subtle. And I hope that you agree with me. But before I bring this subtlety, want to I want to ask a couple of questions. Before I start actually looking inside, what's your impression? Is your impression that basically Yitzhak made a mistake and he thought that Esav was the one who will end up being the future for the Jewish people? Did Yitzchak imagine that the Jews would pray in the future, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Esav? Or was he, again, is that what we think? He wants to give the brachot to Esav. So therefore he believes that Esav is going to be the continuity of Avraham and Yitzchak. Is that the case or is that not necessarily the case? So therefore, is the result of Yaakov stealing the brachot that Yaakov ended up stealing to be the future while it was supposed to be Esav? Is what I just now said the way that you would understand it or not necessarily? Yes? Okay. Yes? Good. No, no. Why not?
Just because he wanted the physical to keep the family together doesn't mean he wanted to put them on the same level necessarily.
Okay. Good. So how do we evaluate? So it actually comes down to one very simple point. In last week's parsha, there were three brachot. What are the three brachot? One, which may be the main discussion. That's the bracha that Yitzchak wanted to give to Esav, that Yaakov took. Okay, clearly stated, bracha number one. Bracha number two, when Esav comes in, and Yitzchak realizes that it's Esav, and realizes Yaakov took the other bracha, then he says, give me a bracha, and he says, your brother took your bracha. He goes, you have anything left for me? So he gives him a second bracha. So that's bracha number two. Yes? We have distinction two. What's bracha number three? Bracha number three is what he gives Yaakov when he knows that it's Yaakov. Right? At the very end of the parsha. Should I say that again, or that's clear? Three brachot. The one he gives Yaakov when he thinks it's Esav, the one he gives Esav when he knows it's Esav, the one he gives Yaakov when he knows it's Yaakov. So the truth is, the way to really break through that whole parsha is to take the three brachot, line them up one after the other, and take a look and see what is the content of those brachot. Once you know the content, then you'll understand everything. So, if you look at source number 11, we'll get to our first bracha. What's the introduction to that bracha? The introduction is actually source number 10. V'yi Esav ben arba'im shana, v'yikach isha et Yehudit, bat be'eri hachiti, v'et basmat bat elan hachiti, v'tiena morach ruach liyitzlak ulerivka. Esav is 40 years old, and he gets married. He marries a Jewish girl. How do you know she's Jewish? I'm just kidding. Her name was Yehudit. No, but she's not Jewish. It says that she's a Chittite. And Basmat, she's a Chittite. He actually does a couple of things which are really bad right here. What are the things that he does which are really, really wrong? And how do I know that they're wrong? Look at his parents' response. By the way, both his parents, his mother and his father, are very bitter because of this. So what are the two things that he does? One is that he marries these local girls, even though he knows very well that his father went out of his way to make sure that his grandfather, Avraham, would have a way to make sure that Yitzchak would not marry a local girl. He's oblivious to all this and marries a local girl. What's worse than that? By the way, before I say it gets worse than that, how do I see the superficiality of Yitzchak? Of Esav? How old is he when he gets married? He's 40 years old. How old was his father when he got married? He's 40 years old. So look, I'm just like my father. But what's the difference? The difference is that he goes and marries the person who's the correct person to marry, not one of the local girls. What's the second thing that he does, which is very disturbing? Is that he marries two women right away. Now, I do understand that there are various biblical characters that marry more than one woman, especially, you can tell me, the patriarchs as well. But when it always happens for the same reason, and that is one of infertility or one of incredible deceit. But that's where this happens. To start off right away and marry two is itself very interesting, but it's also disturbing. I wrote about this once on an essay in Parshat Noach. If you're interested, I can tell you know where it is, where you can find it, and so on. But essentially, there are midrashim that tell us the first person to marry two wives is a man named Lemech. Lemech married two women. And the midrash tells us that he marries one. He says that was the custom in those days. He married one woman to bear children. He married the other woman to keep her unchild and to keep her beautiful. Now, by doing this, what does he do? First of all, I don't know if any of you recognize how sexist this is, because it's immediately looking at a woman in terms of her utility, right? This one is to bring children, this one is for entertainment. In today's society, we're far more sophisticated, so people generally do the same thing, but they don't do it at the same time. They marry one woman and have a bunch of children, get rid of her, and then marry a younger woman later. But they do the same thing, but that's really what they're blaming Lamech for. They're blaming Lamech for looking at women in terms of utility and saying that this woman is to bring children. That Esav starts off right away and marries two women is something which is disturbing, and maybe you didn't notice it, but I'm just pointing it out. It is disturbing, but it's the local women. His parents are upset with him. Moritzrua, his father and his mother are both upset with him. This then is that's the verse right before, and Yitzchak gets old, and then he calls Esav in for a blessing. So therefore, just in case you're wondering, has Yitzchak been completely fooled by Esav's behavior? The answer is no. He's not completely fooled at all. Why? Because it says that he's really upset with the choices that Esav has made until this point. And I'm saying that's immediately before that. You can't just gloss that over and say, oh no, he fooled him 100%. There's another Rashi that maybe we'll look at as well. It says that he goes and he calls Esav in, go bring me the thing, I'm going to bless you. Okay? Yaakov comes in, and this is a very strange verse. Source 11. Vayigash Yaakov. Now again, he thinks it's Esav. Vayigash Yaakov el Yitzchak Aviv, Vayimushehu, and he feels him. Vayomer, and he says, Hakol kol Yaakov yadayim de Esav. The hands of Yaakov, the voice is Yaakov, the hands of Esav. Remember what I've told you in the past? Not that we've had all that many classes so far, but what have I told you? What is the most basic part of interpretation of texts? The most basic part is knowing the tone of voice which is used. When he says, it's the voice of Yaakov, the hands of Esav, does he say it with a question mark, or does he say it with an exclamation point? Is that a fair question? If he said it with a question mark, which I think is the way that a lot of us tend to read it, then it makes no sense whatsoever that he continues. If Yitzchak is old and Yitzchak is blind and he does not know who's standing in front of him, then he should stop immediately because there's something which is very, very wrong. The fact that he proceeds is what's interesting. So that leads me to say that maybe he doesn't say it with a question mark, he says it with an exclamation point. By the way, one of the most convoluted commentaries you will ever see is something which the Beit Halevi said, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the great-great-grandfather. He said that Esav was suspicious that Yaakov would steal the bracha. Why? Because he already took from him the birthright before. So Esav says to... Again, follow this if you like. Esav says to Yitzchak, I'm worried my brother's going to come in. But if he comes in, he's going to try to dress up like me. He's going to try to talk like me. So therefore, what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk like him. So therefore, if I talk like him, then you'll know that it's me. Because if he's dressing up me, he'll talk like him. So it says that he comes in and he says, oh, look, Hakol Yaakov Dani Esav, so it must be Esav. So you realize how convoluted that interpretation is, right? Now, the only reason he could say such a thing is because he's really bothered by what I raised. How in the world could he proceed if he thinks that, if he's confused? Even confusion. You have something very valuable. You're about to give a blessing, and you don't know who it is. You're not going to continue. So it goes back to my point. Does he say this a question mark or say it with an exclamation point? So apparently, and by the way, look at Rashi right now. Kol Yaakov. Rashi does not understand it like the Beit Halevi did in terms of the tone of voice, the texture of voice. Rather, he understands it in terms of the content. Kol Yaakov shemidaber belashon tachnunim. Because he speaks in a polite manner. Kum na. Please get up. Aval Esav belashon kuntria diber yakum avi. Get up. So he says it's the content of what they say. If you read the two, when the two sons come in, when Yaakov comes in making these Esav, he says, please, father, get up. And Esav comes in, get up. You know, it's almost like, get up, old man, and you know, give me my blessing already. It's the way that they're talking, which is what leads him to say, no, kol kol Yaakov edani Esav. But again, I'm going to say, does he say that with a question mark? The other thing, of course, is that Yaakov, when he comes in, he goes, why did you come back so quickly? And he says that God, you know, was involved in all this and God helped me. So when he hears Esav saying, Baruch Hashem, you know, thank God that's how I got to where I am, That probably is a good part of this Kol Yaakov, that Esav's talking Yaakov, but Azazel he doesn't stop. Why? Because that was his educational agenda from the beginning, to take Esav, to take the hunter, to take this Nimrod, and try to give him spirituality, try to give him a bracha, try to say thank, which means Esav comes running in from the field, right? All bloody and, you know, after the kill and so on, and he brings him this food, and he puts it on the grill, and he hands it to his father, and his father says, thank you so much. Wait 1 second. Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech haolam, shakol nieh b'varo. And then he takes a bite of the meat. Which means what Yitzchak is trying to do is to take Esav's role and then to turn it into some kind of a spiritual experience. So in order to teach Esav that, no, you could be a hunter, but you can still be involved in this and be someone who's spiritual. So now when Esav is talking like Yaakov, so he's ecstatic.
Wishful thinking.
It's wishful. He's ecstatic. Why? Because he thinks he's succeeded. That's the point. He thinks he has succeeded in taking Esav and making Esav somebody else. Now, how far this goes still remains to be seen. Because I want to continue and look at the content of what the bracha is. Look at, now, continuing in Source 11, Pasuk Kav Zayin, V'yigash, V'yishaklo, V'yirachad reach begadav, V'yivarchehu. He smells him and he blesses him. Your smell is like the smell of the field which God has blessed. Again, he talks about the field in terms of blessing of God. Remember another thing. Where does Yitzchak go out to pray? He goes out to pray in the field. Yitzchak is a field. The Gemara says that. Right? Avram is a har, Yitzchak is a field, and Yaakov is a house. Right? So it says that it's the field which God has blessed. Yitzchak prays in the field. Yitzchak is trying to bring spirituality to the field. Spread things out a little bit. Now here's the bracha. V'yitain lecha Elokim mitala shamayim ushmanei aretz v'rov degon v'tirosh. May God give you all of this plenty. All the plenty is the stuff of the field. What's the blessing? May you have stuff of the field. Yavducha amim. May many nations work for you. V'yishtachavu lecha le'umim. And may many nations bow down to you. Hevigvir la'achecha. And may you be powerful compared to your brother. V'yishtachavu lecha b'nei imecha. And may the sons of your mother bow down to you. Aruch, arur, mevrech, baruch. And may those who curse you be cursed, and may those who bless you be blessed. Now, the obvious thing over here is that he gives him part of what sounds like a bracha, which is Avram's bracha, right? This ability to curse and to bless. What are the elements of the bracha that he gives? One element was, what did we say? What element is? It has to do with the field. It has to do with what we would call gashmiut. It has to do with wealth. What's the second thing? It has to do with power. Power and wealth is what he's giving him. What's the third thing? Is that the power is going to include that other nations will bow down to you. But then he says something else. Other nations will bow down to you, and your brother will bow down to you. So what's the implication of that? As I said, this is the most subtle point I'm going to say today. What's the implication of that? That your brother is part of a different nation or part of your nation? No? May other nations bow down to you, and may your brother bow down to you. So it's part of the same nation. Because if his brother's part of a different nation, then he would be included, may other nations bow down to you. No. I'm just saying, I absolutely admit that this is a subtle point, but this is the point you have to listen to very, very carefully. Because when Yitzchak is giving the bracha that he's giving is one of finance, one of power, but he also says something over here, which is, your power will include your brother, but other nations and your brother, which means your brother's not included in other nations, otherwise it would not have had to be said. Is that point clear? Because that point is essential. Yitzchak believes, right? I said this at the beginning, you let me get away with it, you didn't ask me how I know. Yitzchak believes that Yaakov and Esav will be part of one nation.
He's talking about succession, that it will go on and last.
Right, one nation. They are part of one nation. That's what Yitzchak believes. Rivka does not believe that. Rivka does not believe they're going to be part of one nation. Rivka believes that they are going to be two different nations. How do I know that? If you look at source number 6, Vayeter Yitzchak LaHashem Lenochach Ishto Ki Akarahi Vayeter Lo Hashem Vatar Rivka Ishto. Yitzchak prays in front of his wife. For some reason, Rashi says that they both prayed. But he prays in front of his wife, for she was infertile. The Yeter Lo Hashem, God responds to him. But Tahar Rivka Ishto, and she becomes pregnant. And the children start to make some kind of trouble within. There's a big machloka what Vayitzitzu means. But Tomer, and she says, "In Kain, Lamaza Anochi, what do I need this for?" And she seeks to search out God. Vayomer Hashem La. By the Rashi over here again will tell us that where does she go? She goes to Beit Midrash Hashem Be'eruv. Why? Because the word Betelech is here. She goes. So there's some kind of movement. Vayomer Hashem La. God says to her, Shnei goyim bevitnech, shnei le'umim miyachi paredu. There are two nations within you. Two separate countries, two separate peoples. And they're going to separate and go do different directions. Ula'omi lo mi'emats, v'rav yovor tse'ir. But the younger one is the one who's going to ultimately be the victorious one, which means she has the ultimate inside information. She knows that these are two separate nations. So now,
She
already knows this. God says this to her. She has this information. Vayomer Hashem La. God says it to her. But here Rashi does bring. He says Vaya Hashem Ve'ever. Strange that Rashi, because I think that Rashi is just going on the last part. Because Vatelech, she goes later on when it says that she hears that Esav wants to. Esav, it says Vayomer Esav Bekirbo. Esav says inside. He says to himself. So how does she hear that? So there Rashi says, Ruach HaKodesh. So Rivka certainly is somebody who has prophetic ability. She knows something. So I'll go back to your question now. First, before you can even ask that question, I have to ask a different question. Did she share the information with Yitzchak? Did she ever share this? So what's the answer? Apparently no. How do we know that? Based on the bracha we just now read. Goes over there, she knows they're two different nations, and Yitzchak refers to Yaakov as being within the same nation as Esav. So from that point, it seems to be that is the core of the separation between the two. But I do have to point out something else. Remember I said there were three different brachot? Right? So the first bracha is physical. It's physical bounty, physical power. The last part is interesting. Blessing you is blessed, cursing is cursed, but it's also a relationship to the brother. When Esav comes in, and Esav now realizes, and Yitzchak now realizes what has happened, that Yaakov took that bracha, and he says, okay, do you have a blessing for me? So what does Yitzchak then respond and say to him? Yes? Look at source number 3. V'yecharad Yitzchak harada gedola ad ma'od. Yitzchak was very frightened because now he realizes that everything that he thought was wrong. He thought that Esav and Yaakov will work together. Now he realizes that he was wrong. V'yomer mi efo hu hatzad tzayid v'yaveli ochel mikol b'terem tavo v'rechehu gam baruchiyeh. The one who blessed me is going to be blessed. Kishmo Esav v'tzvei aviv v'yitzak tzaka gedola mara ad ma'od. He says, bless me as well. Your brother came surreptitiously, and he took your blessing. So now, let's pause. Does this mean that Yitzchak has no other blessings up his sleeve? He does have another bracha up his sleeve. How do I know? Because he's going to give Yaakov another bracha before Yaakov leaves. So I want to read that bracha right now. See what he gives Yaakov when he knows that it's Yaakov. And I think that this then will be enlightening and the whole thing will now start to make more sense and then we can get back to our dream. Source number 5. Number 4, there's the Rashi that I just mentioned to you about Ruach HaKodesh. Source number 5. V'yikra Yitzchak el Yaakov. Yitzchak calls Yaakov. This is after when he tells him you're going to go and not marry a local girl. He blesses him. Don't marry a local girl. By the way, what's missing here? Yelling at him. How dare you come in surreptitiously? How dare you take the bracha without me knowing? How dare you fool me? Not a word. Kum lech padana aram, beta bituel, avim imecha. Go. V'kach lecha misham isham ibnot lavan, achi imecha. V'kel shakai yivarechotcha, and may God bless you. May you be fruitful and multiply. Vayit lekal amim. Maybe you become a nation. Vayiten lecha et birkat Avraham. May God give you the blessing of Avraham. Lecha ulazaracha itach. For you and your descendants forever. Lerishtacha et eretz mugurecha. Ashenotanu lukim Avraham. To inherit the land that God gave Avraham. Do you realize now? This was never on the table to give to Esau? Remember when I asked before the question, was Yitzchak so confused that he was going to give the bracha of Avraham to him? The land of Israel was going to him? We would be praying and say, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Esav? No. That was never on the table. Which means, this is the bracha, again, 2 points. The bracha that Yaakov stole from Esav had none of those elements. Didn't have the land of Israel, didn't have Birchat Avraham. When Esav comes in afterwards, what does he say? Do you have any bracha left? He goes, no, your brother took your bracha. Does he have another bracha yet left? Of course he has another bracha. He has, by the way, if you would ask us, a better bracha left. What's the better bracha? The spiritual inheritance and the physical inheritance of Avram Avinu. That he still has up his sleeve. He goes, no, sorry, your brother took your bracha. So how fooled was Yitzchak all along the way over here? Yitzchak wants to give physical things to his physical son, but he wants to give him physical things which will be connected to spirituality. But what ends up happening? His spiritual son comes in and shows him that he has much more of an understanding of the world than he ever thought. And he comes in and he shows him that he knows how to deal with the physical things in this world, and that his spiritual son could be involved in the physical as well. He goes, no, he'll be blessed. But by the way, you want me to put it into a more contemporary setting? What do you think will be easier? To take Haredim and give them a sense of the modern world, or take a modern secularist and give them a sense of spirituality? What would be an easier thing to do? So what's interesting is that Yitzchak thought it would be easier to take the secularist and give him spirituality. And what does he end up finding out? He ends up finding out that his Haredi son Yaakov actually will be able to deal with the real world as well. That's the... If you prefer that as a metaphor. If you hate it, then I apologize. I never meant to say it. But that's basically what happened. And by the way, I'll be so strong and perhaps arrogant to say, I don't see how you can even explain this in any other way than what I'm saying right now. And therefore, the key to this whole part becomes the three brachot. What he wanted to give Esav, what he gives Esav afterwards, what Yaakov takes from Esav, what he wanted to give Yaakov. These are all different things, which means that there is no illusion over here. Yitzchak knows that his son Yaakov reminds him of his father Avraham, a man of the tents, a man of spirituality. And he's going to give him Avram's bracha all the way along. But what was supposed to be the relationship? Apparently the relationship should have been that that Yaakov should have been sort of like what we would describe today as the Kohanim. They're the ones who should have been involved in the spiritual world, while, again, the relationship that we end up having between the Kohanim versus the rest of Klal Yisrael, the others work, the others do things, the Kohanim are the priests, the ones who are involved in the spirituality. So, the Kohanim involved in spirituality, and the others involved in the government, involved in commerce, involved in other kinds of things, and they end up working together. That's the dream that Yitzchak has. And by the way, if you go back a little bit, I want you to now appreciate Yaakov's difficulty. Yaakov grows up, and what is being told to him the whole time? His father says, partners, one for all for one, two musketeers, right? You guys are together, you're going to work together, and he keeps saying this. And what does Rivka keep whispering in his ear? Your brother's a loser. He's not part of the Jewish people. I have inside information. Maybe she did tell him. I have a prophecy from God. It's not going to work out. And now I want you to go back to the difficulty of Yaakov. So you have Yaakov walking around saying, his father says, you'll be involved in the spiritual stuff. You're like Avraham Avinu. He'll be involved. He's the hunter, but he'll be not a hunter like Nimrod. He's going to be working for you. He's going to be taking care of your physical needs. You'll take care of his spiritual needs, and you guys are going to work together. When does Yaakov realize that his mother was right? When it says that Esav comes in from the field, and he says to Yaakov, give me food. By the way, he says, give me food because I am... Give me food because I am... Yeah, it doesn't say hungry. He says, I'm tired. Tired. Ki ayefanochi. I'm tired. I'm going to die soon. Do we have that here or no? He He says, give me food because I'm tired. Tired, by the way, is not the same thing as hungry. Tired also can very well be emotional. I mean, Chazal go into a whole discussion, perhaps, of even depression.
He had the implication he was
going to
die if he didn't get the food.
No, but he says, I'm tired, I'm going to die soon. He's a young man, why is he talking about that? So Chazal says it's the day that Avraham died. And therefore he gets depressed. And he says, you know, what difference does it make anymore? Everyone's going to die. So I'm saying it reads as depression more than it reads as hunger. Give me food. So at that point, when he comes in depressed and tired, so it's also existential tiredness. I'm tired of my life. I'm tired of my role. I'm tired of trying to fool my parents into thinking I'm decent. I'm tired of living up to my father's expectations. He's tired. Again, he's hungry. So then he says to Yaakov, give me food. So what does Yaakov then realize? The second he asks him for food, what was his role supposed to be? He's the hunter. He's supposed to bring Yaakov food. So when he says to Yaakov, give me food, what does Yaakov now realize? That his mother was right. That moment he realizes his mother's right. He says, okay, fine, I'll give you food. You give me the Bechorah. He goes, fine. And he detests it. He doesn't want it. Which means, again, Yaakov hears two different messages, and Esav confirms that his mother was right. And Esav confirms that Yitzchak is wrong. So now, when we go to the point later on, that his mother says, okay, go in and you need to take this bracha as well. Why does he listen to his mother? Because his mother has a prophecy, and his mother's working off of the prophecy, and as how difficult as this is, and how morally challenging this may be, Yaakov sides with his mother's over here. Again, she's got the prophecy on his side, and he saw himself, he knows that Esav is never going to live up to his father's dreams. And his father comes to realize it as well. And when does his father realize it? His father realizes it when Yaakov comes in. He realizes that, hold it, Yaakov can handle both sides. So then where does that leave Esav? Because again, he never had the illusion that Esav was going to be the one who's going to deal with all the spiritual. He just tries to give him as much spiritual stuff as he can. But Birchot Avraham, there was no question that goes to Avraham. So now we can understand the beginning of this week's parasha a lot better. Yaakov leaves. But Yaakov, on the other hand, has had this conflicted experience. You want to ask something, or?
Yeah. So that Yitzchak wants to be just physical
bracha
and to Yaakov just
spiritual. Right. So now Yaakov leaves conflicted. As I said, he's got all the blessings in the world, but everything is a potential. Nothing is real yet. He goes to sleep. What does he ask for? All that he asks for is, as I said, shirt on his back, bread to eat, just take care of me, which means real basic, which is we still get the sense of Yaakov, the man of the tents, as he leaves. Now the question which should be hovering above us, so how does God deal with this? So now we can read again the beginning of this week's parasha, and I think everything is going to come into line. Let's start again from the first source. Yaakov leaves. Why does he leave? He leaves on two different missions, on his mother's and his father's mission. But you know what's great about this mission? They finally told him to do the same thing. Which means his mother's been telling him one thing and his father's been telling him something else for all these years. Now they finally tell him the same thing, even though it's for different reasons, but at least now they told him the same thing. That is, again, I can't exaggerate how comforting that must have been to Yaakov, that for the first time in a long time, both of his parents want the same thing from him. Yes? So that's the first thing. And he has a dream. And he dreams and he sees a ladder which is really has its feet in the ground, as it were, and its head reaching all the way up into the heavens. And the angels of God go up and they come down. And God is upon either him or the ladder. It depends what the alav is modifying. And says, Ani Hashem Elokei Avraham Avich Elokei Yitzchak, Haaretz Asher Ata Shochev Aleh Lachat Nenu Ulazarecha. The land which you're lying on, I will give to you and to your children. So what did God... Now, we have no evidence and actually no reason to believe that God has ever spoken to me before. Now, for the first time, God speaks to him. Right after he has fooled his father. Right after he's forced to run away. Which means he could have had second thoughts. He could have said, well, maybe this was the stupidest thing I've ever done. And now what happens instead? God speaks to him. What does God say to him? He confirms. Now, the first thing he confirms is the last bracha that he got from his father. What was the last bracha? Birchat Avraham and the land of Israel. So the fact that God is speaking to him, it's, again, just I want you now to realize, again, how much Yaakov's life now is coming together. His mother and his father tell him to do the same thing. Now God speaks to him. And now God tells him that the bracha that his father gave him, again, so far part of it, is true. But Yazar, what? Well, so far, I said so far. We only got one pasuk. We have more. But Yazar achaka afar ha'aretz, and your descendants will be like the afar ha'aretz, dust of the earth. Ufaratz te yama v'kedma v'tzafon v'negva v'nivruchu b'cha kol mishchot adama uv'zarecha. And everyone will be blessed through you. Now, this is not exactly who you bless is blessed, who you cursed is cursed, but this means you will have a blessing. This blessing itself, by the way, is very, very close to the first bracha that Avram got. If you just let your eyes go down to source number 2 for a second, this is right after the Lech Lecha, when Avraham is told to go to the land of Israel. You will be a blessing. That's what he says over here. All nations will be blessed through you. That's what he says here as well. Not only will you, your descendants, which means he clearly gets the bracha that you are the Jewish people, you will get the land of Israel, you and your descendants, which means it's not just you, this now is going forward as well. Everything will come true. Now, I will readily admit at this point, what I don't see yet is the bracha for the physical. For the physical. I don't see the bracha for the physical yet. I will take care of you. I will take you back to this land. You're going to have the land of Israel. You are going to be the Jewish people. The covenant that I made up with Avraham is going to come through you. Okay, all that.
It's not picky for me now to say, so what did you say? He was the same family as Ishmael? The others and Ishmael.
All right, so yeah, but over here, he's
left him out. No?
Esav is left out. This is only going to be Yaakov at this point. So now let's try again. You know, God could have just spoken to him and told him all this. What do we have to ask ourselves? So why does he get the vision that he gets? Which means, we've had many examples of God speaking to people. Very rarely have there been examples of seeing visions. The vision that he sees is to me quite interesting. What is the vision? It's a ladder that has its feet on the ground and at its head up into the heavens. And more than that, it says that it sees the angels walking up and walking down. So, it strikes me, and I will tell you, the Midrash has many, many suggestions to what this ladder may be and what it's representing and what its message is. I just want to try, really, I'm saying almost on the simplest level, maybe even, I would almost be willing to call this Pshat, that he's talking about an ability of having your feet on the ground and your head in the heavens, which seems to me that the vision itself is a combination of the two blessings. The blessing that was destined for Esav, the blessing that was destined for Yaakov. The ability of having your feet on the ground is to be involved in this world, in the real world, and the ability of having your head up in the heavens is to be involved in the spiritual world. And Yaakov receiving this vision, watching a ladder stretching up, merging the physical and the spiritual, and not only that, watching angels go up the ladder, I think is a very clear statement of saying it is possible to reconcile these two separate things which pull us, when we're pulled in the physical world and pulled in the spiritual world, and the very vision that Yaakov gets is really confirming in terms of the blessing that had been designed to Esav that he took surreptitiously, that no, this was meant for you, and your role is going to be to bring these two elements together, and that's exactly what the message of the Sulam is. That again, I'm saying that, I didn't find anybody saying that, I'm saying that almost, I wouldn't say it's pshat of what he sees in front of him, is this link between the two different worlds. Because that's ultimately what a ladder is. A ladder is a way of getting from one place to the other, but he sees this link and he sees angels, and it's very significant. He sees angels going up. An angel, but it's also significant, it's not the other way around. It's not that he sees angels coming down. He sees angels going up, which means you can start on this world, be involved in the physical world, and you can still climb up spiritual levels and be involved in the spiritual world. This, I think, is so significant for Yaakov, who's somebody who has been involved in exclusively, you know, this Avram type of life of being in the tents and being spiritual, and now, again, took this one walk on the wild side into this Esav kind of role where he wears Esav's clothing and so on and so forth. Which, by the way, honestly, I also think is the whole source. You know, Esav eventually becomes Amalek, and Amalek, the whole story with Purim. One of the things nobody knows the reason for is why people dress up on Purim. I think the dressing up on Purim goes right back to Yaakov dressing up as Esav, right at that moment. But, I mean, I could have said that, you know, think about all the hatred and all the evil that could have been avoided if Yaakov didn't do this. But the answer is no. That this Rivka told him to do it, and it was based upon the prophecy, and Yitzchak was mistaken. But again, at what point was he mistaken? He wasn't mistaken on the requirement of what will eventually become the Jewish people of merging the physical and the spiritual world. He's not mistaken about that. The only thing he was mistaken about was his belief that Yaakov and Esav can do it, which means ultimately his mistake was believing that Esav would be somebody who could be ultimately at least redeemed on the short-term basis. That Esav is one who's going to get himself involved in the... Esav's tired of that game. Esav can't live up to that. Esav can't ultimately do that. And again, that's that admission that he has to Yaakov. I'm tired of this. I'm going to die. And what difference does it make anymore? Just you take care of me. Which means it's this realization that Esav, the big hunter, the big strong guy, will eventually turn to the spiritual leader and say, I need help. I need you to take care of me. I need your I need my sustenance coming from you. And that becomes very telling. That's the only mistake that Yitzchak makes. Which means, again, do I think Yitzchak is a wonderful parent of Thor? Of course he is. He looks at his son, he looks what his strengths are, and then he tries to take those strengths and to pick him up with those strengths. He blesses him for his strengths, he encourages his strengths, and he tries to bring spirituality into those strengths. But what was missing? What was missing is the inside information. So now, I want to go back to your question. So why doesn't Rivka tell him? I would suggest one of two things. You can like both if you want, or you can like neither or one. Your choice. One is, I think that she senses, especially the previous scene, they both pray, God answers, especially going to Rashi. They both pray, God answers his prayers. Or he prays, God answers his prayers. He's a very spiritual person, Yitzchak. God chose not to tell Yitzchak. God chose to tell her. Perhaps she feels that Yitzchak is a prophet. If God wanted to tell him, he would have told him. And therefore, the fact God didn't tell him meant that this was not meant for him to know. That this was his will for him to raise. Leading to my second point, should a parent have foreknowledge of how their kid is going to end up? Or is that terrible, terrible information to have? Which means there are sometimes that prophecy is called a burden, masa. It's called a burden. It's difficult. It's a responsibility. It's obligation. And it could be that Rivka's orientation towards this prophecy is, you know, what a curse it is to know that you have one child who's not going to work out very well. Why should I share that curse with my husband? Let him at least give him the love that he needs. Let him at least nurture him. Let him take care of him. Let him do things with him. Why should I share this information with him?
Could you now and say what you said before, so I'll understand in a different light? When you said that he hears the voice, he says, wait a minute, whose voice is this? What does that mean? That he was glad, or he was hopeful, or he was misreading, or that he was better at listening than at seeing?
I think that he believed that Asa...
He said it's the tone of voice.
He thought that Asa had succeeded and bringing some spirituality. He thought he had succeeded, and therefore Esav has been, and not realizing that it wasn't Esav who had brought some spirituality, it was rather Yaakov who had brought a little deviousness into it. And when he realizes that, then he's very frightened, because then he says, everything I thought was wrong, because Esav is not the one who I thought, and Yaakov is not the one that I thought, and then everything takes a different light. As I said, I think that this... I'm sorry if you're mad at me that I spent so much time in last week's parsha. I apologize. But I think only really understanding the tension of last week will then reveal what the sulam is over here. And that sulam, with the feet on the ground and head in the sky, I think is absolutely connected to the brachot, which we expressed last week. And therefore, ultimately, Yaakov now, again, has a dual mission. What's Yaakov's dual mission? Yaakov's dual mission is going to be this reconciliation of the spiritual and the physical, which is going to be a little bit harder than we thought it's going to be, but that will continue next time.
Very sensual part. The feeling and the